Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. My name is Keith Pannell, and today we're going to be talking to someone that knows about proteins, how proteins interact with each other if there's more than one protein, and some of the tools that one uses to sort of assess protein-protein interactions. So, Russell, who's our guest today?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Professor Kevin Burgess. He's a professor, organic chemistry professor at Texas A&M in College Station, Texas. Welcome to Science Studio, Kevin.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
As usual on this program, before we sort of get into the nitty-gritty of learning, you know, what turns you on in terms of what is the science, tell us a little bit, Kevin, how do you become a scientist? What were those driving forces as a young person that got you into science?
Well, as a chemistry teacher, I suppose I should say that I was really interested in it from the beginning, and it's what I've always wanted to do, but that's not really how it was. I was in a school where there was no chemistry until I was 15. The headmaster in England was a historian, and he didn't really believe in science or chemistry that much, so we didn't have a class. And then he left, and the new headmaster was a physicist, and one of the first things he says is there must be a chemistry class. So I signed up for it. I wanted to do chemistry. And they said, sorry, Burgess, you didn't make it. So you're back in the art class. So I went back to the art class, and I studied art for another semester. And at the end of the semester, we were making pots with clay. And I spent an hour making this pot. And at the end of the class, I took it to my art teacher, and I said, I've just made this, and I want to do chemistry. And he looked at my pot, and he took me straight down to the chemistry lab.
And not to actually put pigments to it, just because he wasn't very happy with the pot.
He kicked me out of the art class, and he put me into the chemistry class.
But I think for our audience here, what you've just said for people born here in the United States, well, what was that system? Does that system still exist where they sort of run you around and pick your field for you?
Well, I don't know if it exists anymore, but it did then. So
certainly the subjects that you studied were, in fact, much more to do with someone else's decision than your own. I mean, in my case, it was my parents in cahoots with the teachers in the school, especially at the higher level, you know, post-16, that basically decided what I was going to do. I wanted to do geography and geology and French, and I landed up doing math, physics, and chemistry. And I was given the one opportunity to do something in geography and geology, and that was join a company, Royal Dutch Shell. So I had to go out to work at 16. I said, to hell with that. So I studied physics, chemistry, and math. Anyway, so you got into the chemistry class, you enjoyed it, and the rest is, as they say, history? Or
yeah, I think it helped, actually, being behind everybody else by a semester. So I had to take the book in hand and really study it. And we started with organic, which is what I do now, and I really have enjoyed organic chemistry a lot.
And where did you study in the end?
In England for my degree. Yeah. I was at the University of Bath, and then I did a master's degree in Norwich. Then I went to Cambridge, and I did a PhD.
Okay.
Then I came to the United States at University of Wisconsin in Madison, and I worked with a professor called Barry Trost.
Oh, yes.
Then I went back to Oxford, stayed there for a little while, and went back to Cambridge, and then finally came to Texas in 1986 or 7.
Okay, so your pedigree was pretty good. And then there you are at Texas A&M doing organic chemistry, but as we were saying in the beginning, with a certain sort of emphasis now on the more biological aspects of how proteins interact with one another.
That's what I'm interested in right now,
right.
Yes.
How did you get to that? What was the sort of the journey that got you into being interested in proteins?
Well, I am fundamentally an organic chemistry person, but you've got to look at the field of organic chemistry and think, well, what is important to study? And I think these days, the most important thing for me to study is the interaction of organic compounds with proteins. So how can we design an organic compound to perturb a protein-protein interaction, either make it stronger or disrupt it?
Now, this is something that in my background I've heard as combinatorial chemistry, where you just throw different molecules at it and see how it binds or helps it or folds it. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, do you do combinatorial chemistry, or is that something that's fallen by the wayside?
That's a really interesting question. I have done combinatorial chemistry a lot, and when combinatorial chemistry really happened around about 15 or 20 years ago, I was very, very interested in it. But I've realized that the universe of organic molecules is so huge that you've got to really think about what you throw at a target. So I'm very interested still in making libraries, but my libraries can be very small. They can be 4 or 5, 10 compounds. I'm not interested in high-throughput screening of random structures because so many other people do that these days.
Yeah, and the reason I asked the question, like you said, 20 years ago when it was really hot and the pharmaceutical companies were, you know, doing it and doing it, and the pharmaceutical companies that went out in the jungles and picked leaves did better.
Well, maybe they did. Pharmaceutical companies still do high-throughput screening, and for many types of targets in pharmaceutical chemistry, it works very well. For ion channels and for enzymes, high-throughput screening can be very good. But for protein-protein interactions, I think the important thing is we cannot just put the same types of molecules in the screen and expect good results.
So then, in fact, you say that there's a wide range of potential organic molecules, big and little. But there's also a large range of different proteins. So let's go to the point where how do you choose what proteins you're interested in? What proteins are you interested in and why?
That is a really great question. And I'm so pleased that you asked it because we haven't talked about this before and you've hit the nail right on the head there. So in the pharmaceutical industry, what people will do is choose a protein-protein interaction. And commonly it'd be one that they're very interested in to make money. It's got a therapeutic goal which can be profitable.
Right. Russell has just perked up.
Well, you know, that's actually because the people are sick and they want to pay money to get well.
Yeah, but it's a biology-centered approach because you're trying to force the organic chemistry to do what you want it to do for that particular target. So what I'm doing in my lab is a chemistry-centered approach. So we start with an organic scaffold, and we use a combination of molecular mechanics, molecular dynamics to get the shapes of the molecules, the conformations that are preferred. And then we use data mining to screen all known protein-protein interactions and see where our molecule fits. So I like to think of that as an organic chemistry approach because we take the molecule first and see where it leads us.
Well, then, okay, so how did you choose the molecule? For example, I find acetylenes, that's a molecule with triple bonds, I find them fascinating. You know, they do so many different things, right? Do you have some fascinating combination of units within molecules that you particularly care for, or how do you choose then the molecule?
Again, that's a really good question. So we choose the molecule on a set of criteria which, when I say them, will seem like common sense. So we choose molecules that have a restricted number of conformations. Maybe that's not so obvious. And
the conformation for the audience is simply the shapes. Way you can arrange the shape of the molecule, mm-hmm. whether it's in one axis, another axis, etc.
Right. So a peptide would cover a lot of conformations. The molecules we choose are more rigid than peptides. But we choose molecules with amino acid side chains. Because nature, quite obviously, is telling us that when proteins interact with each other, they do it predominantly by the side chains. Now, you contrast that with libraries in the pharmaceutical industry. They screen maybe a million compounds, and I don't know exactly what they screen, but I think in most pharmaceutical libraries, you wouldn't find more than 4 or 5 molecules with 3 amino acid side chains. And that's the difference between what we're doing and what is commonly done. I think we're just copying nature. We're using the side chains.
But you're creating molecules that weren't known in nature.
Yes.
I mean, you're sitting down and you're using your art class from way back when you were a kid to think, hey, what can I design? I'm not good at pots. I'm going to make a molecule.
Right. But we start with nature as well because nearly every molecule we make has amino acids in it.
Okay. All right. So then you make this molecule or these molecules, and then you go to the structural databases that we have on proteins. We're lucky in science, right, because we have these incredibly automated databases. I mean, 25 years ago, if you wanted to write a paper, you had to go to Chemical Abstracts and painfully go through formula indices. It was Oh, it was terrible. You wonder why you did it. But that was the only thing to do. Now you plug in and you get all this data. So how do you go about choosing then what little groups you want in order for your molecules to interact?
Well, actually, we don't make anything as step one. So step one is we conceive the idea.
Yeah.
And then after we've determined the shapes of the molecules, we go in and using the three most simple amino acid side chains corresponding to alanine, 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 methyl, 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 then we look at the matches that we could get for every protein-protein interaction. And we see which are the most interesting protein-protein interactions that come out of the data mining. So at Texas A&M, on our supercomputer, we can screen of the order of 57,000 protein-protein interactions in 6 hours and come up with maybe a list of 100 or 200 which are interesting in terms of the fit. And then from those, we use just common sense medicinal chemistry arguments to find the most intriguing ones.
Okay, so tell us what you've discovered.
Well, it's early stages yet. So the slow step is always the synthesis. So we've done proof of principle with HIV-1 protease. So we found a match for HIV-1 protease. The data mining told us that we could design an organic compound that would interfere with the dimerization of HIV-1 protease. We made it, and it did.
So there's a potential cure or
it's
prevention.
It's a long way from a cure.
Yeah, sure, but it's a potential.
First step,
I mean, that's why you're doing it.
Yes. But HIV-1
so it inhibits
protease,
the dimerization.
It does, yeah.
And the dimerization is important.
Because HIV-1 protease is not active as a monomer.
Oh, so it's only in the dimeric form that it's active?
Yes.
So if you stop it dimerizing, you're into something?
It
in
cannot
theory.
Be active. Yes.
All right.
Yeah.
And what I mean by dimerization is simply one species hooking up with itself to form a dimeric.
Two bound together. It's not active unless the two parts bind together.
So anyway, that's a sort of a key new discovery that you've just recently made.
And it's more interesting for our technique than it is for HIV-1 protease research, because in AIDS chemotherapy, HIV-1 protease inhibitors are quite well advanced. But it proves that our method works. And now we're looking ahead to what else we might be applying this to. So we found targets in cancer. We found targets in diabetes. We can find targets in antimicrobials.
Right.
It's very far-reaching.
So, I mean, this is multidisciplinary in the sense that you're at the chemistry end of the synthesis. You have to interact with people who are really clued into the biological aspects. But they also need people in computer science, probably, who are sort of somehow facilitating the mining and the analysis.
Yeah, that interaction with the people in computer science was absolutely critical. So I had an idea of exactly what I wanted a data mining program to do. And I went to a computer scientist, and he said, no problem. I think it was a Thursday or Friday, and on Monday he had me a working draft of an algorithm.
That's pretty good.
We refined it over two
but
or three
there,
years.
But in order to do that, you have a computer model that has a picture, if you will, of the molecule that you want to bind to, the protein. And it says what fits, one of these side chains with amines fits better than another one?
Well, what we do is if you can imagine three bonds. So a bond is an interaction between two atoms. So three bonds can be an interaction between six different atoms. So we regard those six different atoms as coordinates. So we have six atoms on our conformations of our small molecules, and we try to identify corresponding six atoms in side chains of proteins as they interact with each other from crystal structures.
Now, it's a sophisticated mining process. You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Paddle. I'm here with Russ Chianelli. And our guest today is Dr. Kevin Burgess from Texas A&M. And he's talking to us about protein-protein interactions and a novel approach that says, hey, let's try and design some molecules that will sort of interact with proteins and change their properties. We'll be back.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. It's sad, Norbert. No matter how much I diet, I'm not getting back to my college physique.
Was it even good then?
Hey, at least it was better. But listen, I've actually lost about 30 pounds recently. I worry about it creeping back.
Hey, here's a study that just might help. It explains why calorie restriction is important. What we eat determines whether or not the weight stays off. It compared three popular diets for weight loss and weight maintenance, the low-carb, low-fat, and low-glycemic diets.
A group of overweight adults between 18 and 40 who had already lost 10% body weight were placed on one of the three diets, but ate the same number of calories.
At the end of 10 weeks, people on the low-carb diet had the fastest metabolism, burned the most calories while at rest, and had the best total energy expenditure.
But it had negative effects, like high levels of the stress hormone cortisol, which can lead to diabetes. They also had high biochemical markers like CRP, which is associated with inflammation and heart disease.
The low-fat diet led to the lowest metabolism and produced the hormone leptin, which can stimulate hunger and cause weight gain. In contrast, the low-glycemic diet allowed stable blood sugar and metabolism levels without spikes in stress hormones and other negative biochemical markers.
A low-glycemic diet uses fiber-rich foods such as beans, fruits, and vegetables, whole grains, lean meats, and healthy fats from nuts, for example. Maybe I'll start eating from this menu.
What this study emphasizes is food choice is crucial to maximizing your metabolism and keeping your weight off. Before starting any new diet plan, talk to your doctor.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pennell, Russ Cianelli, Kevin Burgess from Texas A&M University. We're talking about protein-protein interactions and little molecules that can sort of impact those interactions. So you've designed some little molecules with amino acids sticking out in various places. Alanine, I think you said, the simplest, or one of the simplest. And then you sort of found by algorithms that you got from computer scientists where these might be useful. And you've now applied the technique, and you found that, for example, the HIV-1 protease ceases to sort of hook up as two units together because of interaction with a molecule. Pretty clever. Pretty
and thereby ineffective as a disease.
And then it could be important, yes. So now you've got other targets, diabetes and da-da-da-da. Tell us a little bit about the molecules then. That when you do this study, how do you see that there's an impact? What techniques do you have to use to see that the protein-protein interaction has been modified?
Well, there are various techniques you could use. So, for instance, if we're looking at an enzyme which is formed from two identical proteins, in other words, a homodimer, then if that enzyme is inactive as a monomer but active as the homodimer, we can just use enzyme assays. In other words, we can ask the enzyme what it normally does,
right,
and does it do it in the presence of our compound.
Otherwise, so that's evaluating the property of the resultant system.
Yes, but not every protein is an enzyme. So if we're interested in other protein-protein interactions between proteins that aren't enzymes, then we have to use techniques which look at the molecular mass of the complex. In other words, how heavy is the complex in the presence of our compound?
Ah, I see.
And in the absence of our compound.
But, I mean, if your molecule is a small molecule, then the difference in mass between the protein with the small molecule and without it, that's negligible. So
but
this is only going to apply
if you've got...
between
a protein and another protein.
Yeah, I understand, right. Yeah. So the two, the three, the four together.
Yes.
Let me ask the following question. Here in the border, we have a lot of diabetes victims, if you will. I also have a granddaughter that's type 1, and there is a difference we all know about between type 1 and type 2. I know a little bit about type 1. Could you tell us a little bit more about your thoughts about diabetes?
Well, this really drifts into a social issue from a pure science one, because I think ultimately the answer to the diabetes problem is primarily diet, in what we eat in the first place. So not
maybe
for
type 2, but not
for
type
1. But for type 2 diabetes, there's more and more cases every year, and they're correlated with the type of diet. With regards to the treatment of type 2 diabetes, it's a fascinating disease, but a very challenging one, because there's unlikely to be a cure. There's just more possibility that we can have treatments which suppress the symptoms, just like taking insulin. So that's a more challenging area for someone doing medicinal chemistry, because you have to devise a compound that people will tolerate maybe every single day of their lives. And so if there's any accumulated toxicity, that's a very hard thing to deal with.
And, of course, you don't always discover that there is this toxicity after many years until you've gone through the process
of taking the
material. And then people start to say, well, you know, why were you feeding me this poison? I mean, that's another issue, but it's one that people have to realize that scientists don't know all the answers until the experiment has been done.
And sometimes if the experiment takes 20 years to do, it's impossible to know, like Vioxx.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit, do you think about your chemistry and how it might help people in terms of, or is it mostly focused on the chemistry?
Well, my expertise is chemistry. And to make a drug, it takes a lot of collaborations from many different people. So I like to think of myself as someone near the first step in the process, where I'm developing methodology that other people will find useful at drug companies where they can really put this into play and make pharmaceuticals. But the chances of me making a pharmaceutical...
But you're talking to the drug companies about your work.
That's
what's now known as advanced translational science.
Right. And in fact,
it means they're trying to get money to support the research. I mean, have you had any success in that area?
Well, actually, I've started the company. And the company is just over a year old. I'm the only employee so far. but I'm hoping that this technique, we can commercialize it. And I have started talking to some pharmaceutical companies about doing that.
So you're talking about commercializing the technique that you're using for finding the fits between the molecules and finding the right molecule in the protein.
Yes.
Let's change topics for a little bit, if you don't mind. The only reason that I know you isn't because of the work that you've done with protein-protein interactions, but because you're one of the people that's been working recently on fluorescent molecules. These are molecules that when you shine light on them, they then emit at a different wavelength from the light that you're looking at. And they can be very pretty. They're very attractive. Tell us a little bit about your interest in that type of a molecule. And does it impact your ability to look at protein-protein interactions or conformations and things of that nature?
Yeah, well, as you say, those fluorescent molecules are extremely beautiful. They're some of the most exciting compounds to work with on the bench because you can see them very vividly. They will glow in a dark room when you irradiate them with UV light. These are very pretty compounds. So because they're so responsive to light at such a small level, then you can use them to detect biological molecules. So I started looking at fluorescent molecules for DNA sequencing, where it's necessary to track the fate of DNA as you grow a chain. But then
Hang on a minute. You mean that you tag the DNA strand with the fluorescent tags at different locations and then look at how different chemical or biological processes split the DNA into smaller pieces? Does the tag remain here or does it remain there? Is that what we're really talking about?
Almost right. We were studying conventional Sanger sequencing where instead of splitting DNA, we would make it longer and systematically terminate it in four different experiments. And we need to keep track of which molecule came from which experiment when we mix all these things together. So we would tag the DNA with four different fluorescent dyes. And that's not my idea. That's known. But the dyes that we were using were mine. From there, we went on to look at tagging proteins. And specifically, I was interested in when proteins interact with each other, if they both carry a fluorescent dye, can you tell that they are interacting from the effects of one fluorescent dye on the other?
And when you did that experiment, obviously you've had some success. It worked.
It works, yes. We can make it work, yes. And we can make it work in cells. So in a live cell, we can see interactions between proteins.
And just tell us why two dyes on different parts of a molecule would in fact interact. But they have to be very close. There has to be some, as we call, conformation to bring the die on the left to the die on the right close together. Why don't they act as independents?
They do act as independent when they're far apart. But as they become closer, they tend to resonate with each other,
right,
like some people resonate with each other when they get closer.
Right.
Why does a molecule fluoresce?
A molecule fluoresces because, in the first place, it absorbs energy from UV light, like sunlight. But there are a lot of molecules absorb energy from the sun, and most of them dissipate that energy through vibrations in the infrared region. But some special molecules dissipate the energy by emitting another photon in the UV region. And when they do that, that's called fluorescence or phosphorescence.
So they're relaxing by fluorescing?
Yes, they relax by fluorescing.
I mean, basically, when you provide energy in any form to molecules, this is for the audience, I know you both know it, then the molecule can absorb that energy by rotating more rapidly or vibrating with a bigger amplitude or, in fact, just translating, moving.
Or exploding.
Or by electronic excitation. And so this fluorescence is basically you take an electron, you promote it, and then it drops back down. And when it drops back down, that's when you emit the light.
Yes.
And not all molecules do that.
That's right, yeah.
So it depends upon the molecular orbital structure, basically. And so what you can do is you can tune that so it fluoresces, and then you can tune the side chain so it binds somewhere of interest to your project.
Well, usually with a fluorescent dye, you make the dye separately, and you conjugate it. You add it to a biomolecule that's going to bind to another biomolecule, and you see what's going on that way.
Yeah, and I think for some of the audience out there who's interested in chemistry, and we have some very fine organic chemists here, you didn't emphasize enough how long it takes you to make a molecule. I mean, you can run computers overnight and this and that, but to make what something like you just said may take a couple of weeks.
Oh, a couple of weeks would be a quick one.
That would be lucky. Right.
So it turns out that the fluorescent dyes are relatively not too difficult to make. But some can be very hard. It depends how rigorously you're trying to make a particular structure, yes. But if you're trying to make biomolecules that bind to a protein, that can be quite a long job.
So as part of your earlier program, you had to interact with people writing algorithms for how to get the structural units from, that is, computer scientists. Do you do theory on dyes to sort of determine under what condition you would tune the emission so it would be changing color? Do you do basic theoretical studies also, or are you mainly synthetic?
We've tried the theory studies, and to my mind, so far they don't work. It's relatively easy to predict from theory at which wavelength the molecule will absorb the light. But in between the absorbance and the fluorescence, there are lots of ways to relax a little bit before the molecule spits out that photon.
Right.
And that's almost impossible, I think.
I think we've just about finished. So I think we've come to the end of another riveting Science Studio. Kevin Burgess, thank you very much for being here with us on Science Studio.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
Yes, we'd like to thank you for being here, and we hope to hear more about your new company. And thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
And so, yes, indeed. What a lovely program, and we'll be back next week with yet another program. Keep listening, and bye-bye.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso has announced Jean Novotny as its founding dean of the Gail Greve Hunt School of Nursing. Novotny will continue the work begun by interim dean Josefina Lujan. Novotny previously served as dean and professor at a nursing school in Connecticut. Read more at Synapse, the region's life sciences news digest. Go to mcasynapse.org.